Welcome to Business Uncomplicated, the podcast where we cut through the noise, simplify the complex, and help you smart leaders in the world of change. I'm your host, Rich Nazzaro. Today, we're diving into one of the most urgent conversations facing executives right now, how to harness AI, not just as a tool, but a catalyst to redesign your organization and how it thinks, acts, and evolves. And our guest is a rare thinker who lives at the intersection of innovation strategy and real-world change. Steve Wunker is the managing director of New Markets Advisors, a global consulting firm that has guided ambitious innovators, including nearly 29 of the Fortune 500 companies, towards their next growth wave. He's a founder of four pioneering companies himself, led one of the world's first smartphones to market, and has spent more than a decade working on AI initiatives at scale. He's written hundreds of articles for the world's top business publications and authored multiple best-selling books. His newest book, AI and the Octopus Organization, Building the Super Intelligent Firm, reframes the question we must ask in the AI age. Not how do I automate, but how do I structure a firm that behaves like an octopus, fast, adaptive, and deeply intelligent at every node? In today's episode, we'll talk about why so many AI initiatives fall flat and the biological lessons, yes, biology, that can save them. What does it really mean to build an octopus organization? How are we defining or redefining the role of middle management, and how the democratization of data is leveling playing fields from top to bottom, and truly how luck can help you transform. If you're ready to move past proof of concept and into a future where intelligence, speed, and agility aren't afterthoughts, but baked into your organization's DNA, then let's get into it. Please welcome Steve Wunker. Welcome, Steve, to Business Uncomplicated. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, we're excited to have you. This book was a very interesting read and very timely read from a lot of the work we're doing with clients around AI. And so we're really excited to get into the genesis of the book. But before we get started, maybe let's introduce you, give yourself your background, a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm happy to. I have a long history in innovation. I was responsible for one of the first smartphones 25 years ago, helped start up the mobile marketing, mobile commerce industries. Honestly, Rich, I never thought I'd be a consultant again. I'd started at a big strategy firm right out of business school. And I really like starting things, but I had a chance back in 2004 to join up with Clay Christensen, who had just written The Innovator's Dilemma, The Innovator's Solution, originating concepts like disruptive innovation, jobs to be done. And people would read these books and they'd say, wow, that's great. Now, what do I actually do? So I joined up with Clay to help him start up a consulting practice, figuring out what he actually do about disruptive innovation. Did that for a bunch of years. And then I spun out New Markets Advisors in 2009 that is really focused on how do you make disruptive innovation come alive. We have particular interest or focus in a couple industries in tech and in healthcare, also do a good amount in financial services and consumer goods. So look, we've been working with AI since 2012, worked in it in a bunch of contexts. We'll get into that, but that's sort of the genesis of where we come from. I lead a boutique consulting firm. We're about 15 people based in Boston, and we really get out there and work with companies on the front lines of how to make this come alive.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you say, I've been working with AI since 2012, because a lot of times people think, well, this is just 2 years ago. This is a new thing. But it's really been around a lot longer than people really think.
That's right. Now, look, the types of AI were different. But even back then, AI was pretty good at image recognition in like factory contexts or at algorithmic interpretation. We used it for biometric monitoring and interpretation in medical devices. So the applications have certainly broadened out.
Yeah.
But AI is not a new technology.
Yeah.
Right. The user base is expanding as the technology just becomes more accessible, but that brings a whole host of other issues with it too.
Right.
That's right. It actually makes AI a lot more exciting because it changes not only the technical capabilities, but it changes the dynamics in an organization. as well as competitive strategy. So now we're not just talking about particular applications. We're talking about a real corporate transformation.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you wrote a book, one of your four books, right? AI and the Octopus Organization, right? And I love the metaphor in the book. So you have 9 brains, 8 tentacles, 3 hearts. It really kind of ties things together. But what does it really mean to be an octopus organization?
So an octopus has an anatomy that is very alien to us humans. As you said, it has 9 brains. 2/3 of the neurons in an octopus are not in its core head. They're out in its arms. Each arm has a brain. And that enables it to sense right in the arm and make decisions in the arm very quickly. And then the arms can all communicate with each other without even involving the central brain. So one arm can be opening up a clam and another is exploring a cave. And meanwhile, the central brain is focused on how do I get away from that shark? So it has this ability to undertake massively parallel action and move super rapidly, taking advantage of things opportunistically. So that's what AI enables organizations to do. We can sense closer to the edge. We can decide and take action much closer to the edge without everything going up to the boss or the boss's boss's boss. And we can de-silo, make the organization capable of this massively parallel action while also ensuring that one arm doesn't get tangled up with the other.
Right, right. And that happens so often in organizations today.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm wondering, so with the idea of the octopus, what are the patterns that you see or that you've seen with your clients that really led you to this? Because I'm trying to visualize, okay, I've got this organization. We know where the silos are. Sales is totally separate from marketing, and they may not be talking, and then product may not be talking. Like, give us more visual in terms of what are the patterns that you see that led you to this, and then what does that actually look like in an organization?
So I've seen time and again how technology moves a lot faster than organizations do. I saw it with the smartphone. People were sort of vaguely interested in what they could do, and then they built an app. But for some businesses, it truly transformed not only the company, but even the industry that they're in. And AI is a more revolutionary technology than the smartphone. So it was going to be very clear that AI has this revolutionary potential. And yet people have been very focused on optimizing their 17 steps with putting some AI into each of the 17 steps. And maybe we should actually have 4 steps that are all AI enabled, for instance. So we need to really step back and think transformatively. I've been a little frustrated as the AI boom really took hold over, say, 22, 23, with the narrowness of thinking. People would talk very big, but the actions have been very narrow. What that led to is a whole lot of pilots, most of which didn't really do much aside from distract people. And there's been too little of creating the future of the organization or the industry. So that was a big motivation for getting into this book.
And
yes.
Yeah. Yes to all of that. Right. And it's interesting you talk about the transformation piece, right? That's a lot of what we do. I've spent years implementing Salesforce, been at Salesforce in the belly of the beast, you know, so to speak. And most companies, as they move through this journey, they buy the technology and the technology has to be implemented. I'm already burning dollars on the technology. And they haven't really talked about the why. What problem are we solving? What are we trying to accomplish? And they'll make bold statements like, oh, sales will sell faster. We'll close deals quicker. But how? It feels like that how in this transformation, it feels like history repeating itself with AI, that people are enamored with the technology, not with the transformation.
Well, that's exactly right. And we're so focused on the technology horse race. Look, I mean, the technology is really interesting. And it is neat to talk about what it can do, as well as the different business approaches, say, by Anthropic versus OpenAI. Cool. But when the history of the AI age is written, it's not going to be about who had a better image generator back in 2025, right? It's going to be about how things were fundamentally transformed. You know, we look at the book at electrification, which I think is probably the closest analogy to the transformative impact of a technology. So back in the 1880s, electrification really went mainstream. And factories before that had been steam-powered. You had these big, hulking, steam-powered machines. And, you know, it took about 20 years for organizations to switch out the steam power for electric machines, even though electric was clearly better, because they had so much invested in the steam power, and they had all the infrastructure. And it took another 15 years after that for the big revolution to occur, which was the assembly line. Now, that was the huge unlock for productivity, the assembly line, and it could not have happened without electrification. We don't have 35 years this time to think about what's the big transformative unlock. And for sure, there's going to be a lot more than one, the assembly line. So yes, it's a transformative technology, but we can't be so narrowly focused on the one-for-one exchange of things without asking, how could we really redo this process or this business model in a way that creates the huge unlock?
So I want to talk a little bit about this idea of transformation. And we talk with customers a lot about digital transformation, AI transformation. Part of the cheat sheet in the front of the book is you have reimagining growth. And we talk a lot to customers about what growth in AI means. Talk to me about why this is the first piece on the transformation worksheet. And is it intended to start talking about the transformational behavior around growth that AI can bring? And that's how people should start thinking about this transformation? Or is it something else?
It's a really good question, Rich. I think any sort of disruptive change needs to start with your customers and your competitive strategy. So that is where we begin. Who do you want to be? Now, your cost position is going to be part of that. But if we just frame AI as a cost reducer, that is looking too narrowly. So you really need the broad canvas. I'll give you an example if you want. So I've written about HelloFresh, which is the world's largest meal kit delivery company. They have an ocean of data about customer preferences. They know that you, Rich, likes to substitute chicken for pork, and I like things a little bit spicy. And they know how we've rated our meals over however long we've gotten our meal kits. Yet, they used to give both of us sort of the same binder of options that we could choose our meals from for the next month. And that wasn't a personalized experience. It was also a very cumbersome experience. So they decided to use AI to give people super customized recommendations and what they might like, to give them not only better meals for them, but also just a more pleasant experience, to make them feel special, and of course, to use their data in a really proprietary way. That's a competitive moat. But it didn't stop there. So that was the customer proposition that they were changing, and it started there. But then imagine their kitchens. They used to make 40 meals, let's say, for a given month, and now they're making a couple thousand.
Right.
So that then not only changes operations in the kitchen, but it changes people's jobs. The middle managers, the production managers in the industrial kitchens were no longer creating a spreadsheet on how to produce those 40 meals throughout the week. Now, AI had to do the production planning as well because of the complexity. And the production manager becomes the steward of the model.
Right.
Is the model getting it right? Is there context it's not recognizing? And then how do you explain that and the change that you need to the production workers who are actually making it happen? So it starts with the customer, but then you work backwards into how does the overall organization transform? So the brief answer, yeah, transformation starts with figuring out who are you going to be, and then we'll figure out the rest.
Right. And it's interesting because I think that this whole idea of AI taking everybody's jobs, I think a year ago, right, that was the big fear. Everybody's jobs going away. Now the recent soundbite is, no, AI is not going to take your job. Somebody who knows AI is going to take your job. And what I liked throughout the book was a couple of things, is this idea of bottoms up, right? Giving more autonomy and data to the tentacles, right? To the people who are doing the role and giving them that information. And then this reimagining of the middle manager, which I think most assumed would be a role that would go away to flatten the organization. So I'd like to start first with the bottoms up, right? And a lot of people, I think, in roles that I've worked for or worked with or have worked for me, I think about context, right? So we have a lot of data. We're going to now give you this data that used to be in all these different places. How do you think from a bottoms up, those individuals should rethink about their job in terms of context? Because the people up here making decisions see a broader vision, right? Somebody within the marketing organization, let's say a marketing analyst, may not see that larger vision, but now we're enabling them through AI to see so much more of the organization and even their customers, right? We're bringing all this data in. Talk to me a little bit about how you think those people should think about the skills they should acquire and the role they should start playing in the future.
So people have been talking about devolving authority in organizations since at least the 1980s, Tom Peters and Search of Excellence, that sort of stuff. And yet they didn't really do it. And they didn't do it for a few reasons. They worried that people didn't have the contextual information, like you're talking about. They didn't have the experience base to use that information appropriately. And there weren't checks on what they might do. So if they go and they do something wild, there was no way to catch it before it was too late. AI changes all of that. It gives people the data. It gives people an experience base to assess the data, and it can flag what is and isn't permissible for folks to do. So now we can actually devolve that authority to the front line. Now, what that means for people at the front line is that they need to be good at interpreting what's given to them. Think a little critically about, does that make sense? So we don't just go and do some wild stuff because the computer said so. And they really need to excel at the human element of their jobs, which is often a human relationship, but it can also be just querying, as middle managers are going to have to do as well. AI use is like a dance. I mean, you can dance pretty well individually, or at least, well, maybe you can. I can't. But some folks can. But a dance is even better when it's two people. There's an elegance to it. And it's sort of like that with using AI. You got to like team with it and not just take the answer mutely and go operate. Really query it and understand what is the best answer. So it does require a little bit of critical thinking and dialogue with the AI system.
Do you think that now changes, or let me ask it a different way, do you think the pace of organizational education, whether that be a formal education of 4 years in college coming into the workforce, or somebody like me who's much older, who's been in the workforce a lot of years, how do you think either corporations have a duty to re-educate around some of the things you talked about, or individually educate? And how is this changing kind of how we look at roles and jobs? Because the jobs to be done is going to be different. There's no other way to say it. Like, but it also means that do we look really differently at the skills we're hiring for? And does our current workforce, or even the workforce we're training today, have those skills?
I was having a conversation just this morning with an HR exec at a very big organization, tens of thousands of employees. And she had exactly those questions. What do we need to do to transform this organization? I think there's actually a very hopeful answer here, which is that you don't pluck people from school who have the AI skill set. Can have a lot of people learn what they need to learn. You don't need to have a computer science degree in order to do this. You just need to be able to manage some change. Change is going to happen in a lot of places. But AI is not typically very hard to use. So if we give people the tools and give them a little bit of training, give them practice, give them time to come up the learning curve and a phase transition into new ways of working, I don't think we need to massively reskill or train a user base. It's more about getting everybody involved in learning together and changing together.
That's really interesting. I think probably a lot of people will breathe a sigh of relief with that answer, that I don't have to educate myself completely. The idea of AI and working together. So I've said for years, the silos in organizations drive me absolutely insane. And especially I've spent a lot of my career in IT. So IT is kind of like a funnel at the bottom. And a lot of the organizational ideas come through IT because it's either enabling technology or kind of, you know, part of the transformation. You talked a little bit about that breaking of the silo, and I want to talk about a little bit more. Do you think organizationally that managers and leaders first today recognize the silo and that AI will really break that thinking that I'm not running this organization and you're running that organization and we don't really need to talk to each other because now I know what your organization knows?
So AI can break down silos. It gives structure to unstructured data. And so it can give visibility throughout an organization to what other folks are doing. Marketing can understand what sales are doing. Sales understands what operations is doing. And you can have just natural language queries. You don't have to go into some very complex SAP system to find out all your answers. So that is hugely important for breaking down silos. There is, however, a danger to that. You know, back in 1900, all ships had a tremendous amount of autonomy. The captain got the admiral's instructions and could basically go out there and do what he thought was best. And by 1930, that autonomy had almost entirely gone away. And it was due to one invention, the radio. Because the admirals could give orders, they did. There is a human tendency to meddle in other people's business. So we need to be very careful about not making AI into the new equivalent of the radio. Now that we have visibility into what sales is doing, we're going to go meddle. No. So there are new behaviors that folks need to learn. The information transparency is terrific, but let's also respect what people's specializations are going to be. That's going to have to be a bit of a learned behavior.
So does that change the middle manager role? Is that what starts transforming this middle manager into a person who's interpreting or using this information different than managing, just kind of tasks?
Yeah, I think that that's a really good point. It does. I mean, the middle manager is the translation usually in an organization between the information and the action. They make action happen. And so they might have a lot more transparency of information. What they choose to do with that information is going to have to be a matter of good judgment and a little bit of training and just organizational practices that get instilled. So the middle manager is taking information from AI systems and hopefully querying it using critical thinking and really thinking, how do I get the right answer, the best answer? Right. And then what do I do with that? And how do I coach people to use that information appropriately at the front line? Today, a middle manager is spending 3/4 to 2/3 of their time, roughly, on administrative tasks,
right?
Information processing, alignment, all that sort of stuff. That should decrease a lot with AI. AI processes information pretty well.
Right.
But what a middle manager is going to need to do is be the steward of the model, like in the example about HelloFresh, and figure out, does that make sense? And then all middle managers are going to have to become change managers because there's just so much change that's going to happen not only in their jobs, but in the folks who work for them.
I mean, let's be honest, change management is something most organizations don't do well. We joke about it. When I was at Accenture, it's the first line item that gets cut from the SOW. We'll do it ourselves. It's a multi-million dollar transition and you're assigning one person part-time. That's not really a recipe for success. And so as we move into the AI world, the transformation, I guess the transformation steps haven't changed. The technology's just gotten better.
Well, that's right. I think what does change is that historically, change management has been thought of as a leadership responsibility, a senior executive responsibility. And if you think about like John Cotter, Elizabeth Moss Kander's work, it's very focused on the C-suite. That still applies. But a lot of the change is going to be in the day-to-day. And that's where the middle managers have to be the change managers. I share your skepticism with how much of these transformation plans are going to stick if people don't have very clear competencies, but also metrics about how change is going to be occurring.
And we talked about this being about, you know, the customer and in thinking about the customer and how the customer kind of is going to lead to kind of changes in your organization. And what I found interesting was that most transformations, as we know, what 70%, whatever number you want to take, fail. The latest numbers from like MIT, I think, 95% of organizations are getting zero out of this. Do you think that it's because they're looking too inwardly and not externally? Do you think that these are failing because it's, well, I'm just dipping my toe in the water. I'm not really ready for this big transformation. Transformation is a scary word, and I don't want to do that yet.
So the MIT statistic about 95% of transformations or AI projects failing,
yeah,
is based on a definition of failure about not achieving a significant ROI for the overall corporation. So yes, AI pilots have been too small to do that. If the objective is to get people familiar with AI, okay, fine, it's been doing that. And that is probably a step you need to go through, albeit maybe not spend a huge amount of money on that. So you mentioned that a lot of organizations are really bad at change management. Another thing they're really bad at is experimentation. They don't define the objectives of experiments very well. They don't figure out what they're trying to learn from them, nor how they're going to learn. They don't take away the learnings very clearly. They don't shut down experiments. They don't scale up experiments that are succeeding. And so that's how you get the 900 zombie projects that are neither quite alive nor quite dead. They just sort of go forward and extract a lot of energy from the organization. So they need to get better at that. I don't think that the takeaway is that AI fails. It's that the implementations of AI are not set up to succeed.
Do you think people think the traditional way of doing projects should be thrown out and there's a new way of doing it because of AI? Or do you think people just haven't realized that, guys, we're going to follow the same playbook. We're just going to do it instead of in 6 months. We're going to do it in 3 or in some instances, a week. Is it just the velocity of the output can be better? Or do you really think people haven't triggered into, guys, this is just like any other transformation we would have done, whether we bought Salesforce or an ERP and, you know, 10, 15 years ago?
Well, I think a lot of the ambition around AI is actually too modest in terms of the individual objectives of projects. Sometimes in the C-suite, it's too ambitious. People are thinking, we're going to reduce our headcount by 50%. I have not yet seen a workplace where that's feasible. 25% maybe, not 50%. So if you look at process optimization and 5% efficiency gain, maybe you can achieve that. But that's leaving a whole lot on the table. People are then incented to think rather small and in things that are very readily achievable. That's great. But if you're not also thinking about creating the future in a more significant way, then somebody else is going to do that in your industry, and that will be a problem.
So on this idea of cost, there was something that jumped out at me when I was reading the book. And you talk about these factors around labor scarcity, capital constraints, geopolitical. But then you talked about energy and infrastructure. And it was really interesting. The CEO of NVIDIA just said, hey, China's going to beat us because their energy costs are cheaper and they're going to win the AI race. Partly because of that. And it's interesting because we hear Meta wants to build a, you know, data center the size of Manhattan, and it's going to take so much energy to power it. And data is now the new currency. Do you think that as we evolve into the AI revolution, that this will be something that holds us back, that governments aren't really ready to invest in the energy needed for the future? And will this become, hey, the companies that can afford the energy own the data and own the play, and smaller companies are going to be at the mercy of this? Because I don't know that anybody really thinks of energy in this conversation at all.
So the path that folks have been charting out now is a linear extrapolation from how we've been doing things the past 2 or 3 years. It is absolutely unsustainable. There is not the energy capacity. There are just tremendous constraints throughout on that system. And then you have companies like OpenAI saying they're going to be investing $1.6 trillion in capacity. Well, last time I checked, they actually did not have $1.6 trillion cash. So I don't think that's sustainable either. You certainly don't have the energy available to power these data centers. People talk about small modular nuclear reactors. The number of those that are actually in production powering data centers in the U.S., zero. So that is a solution for the future. However, that's looking at it as it's been. If you look at a model like DeepSeek, for instance, it is a much more efficient model to run in terms of compute capacity. So it may be that the leaner models that are more purpose-built for particular applications are a lot more feasible to roll out. That may mean that we don't do some things that are particularly data intensive, like a lot of video generation. It takes an enormous amount of compute to do that. Okay. There's plenty else that can be done with AI in the meantime.
Sure. No, that makes sense. It was just interesting because I don't think it's something that people are really talking about. And so the book kind of brings in these notions that, hey guys, this isn't a linear path forward. This isn't like when Salesforce created no software in the cloud. And, you know, there's a lot of other factors at play here. And I think it's interesting how you kind of touch upon those and go into those into the book, because it really does then start giving contextual expansion to people like, well, what are we talking about here when we're talking about AI, and what direction should we be going? And how does that influence it in terms of who we're buying? So information or data. So let's talk about that, because it's now the new currency, right? And it's funny because years ago, you know, big data was the 90s, big data. And now it's rearing its head. And I don't think many people have changed their data approach since the 90s, whether it's, you know, optimizing or keeping it clean, because it's expensive. Let's be honest, it's cost to a company. And I love the story about the penny post and how the democratization, like, it was just such a great visual to give people around, oh, wait, this information wasn't always readily available. And then we made it available through the penny post. And now people could get information and bills could be paid in days instead of weeks. So we talk about the democratization of data through the tentacles, right? Everybody has their data set. Even with clients I'm working for, we're talking about democratization of IT. So why does IT now have to build that? Why can't you build that? We're going to give you access. We're going to give you the data sources, but you go figure out what that prompt is, what that information means to you and how you're going to use it. Do you think giving this autonomy to the businesses strengthens the outcome businesses will achieve? Because now I, as the CS leader, have access to your point earlier, all the sales data, all the marketing data, and I can pinpoint renewals better. Or do you think because sales and CS and marketing now see the same information, that there'll be this overlap of decisions being made, which might cause customer confusion?
Well, I think it's probably a little bit of both. People are going to need to figure out new ways of working. And so the delineation of authority is going to get a little messy as people make that transition. But as data gets available, there is just so much optimization that can be done of what was being done before. So I'll give you an example. P&G, Procter & Gamble, has an enormous amount of data that it could be used, right? You have thousands of customer interviews and focus groups. There are lots of experts throughout this humongous corporation in packaging and chemistry, what have you. Recently, Procter & Gamble launched a system called ChatPG that enables people throughout the organization to ask very specific questions, like around some packaging and the machining tolerance and packaging. Now, previously, they would have had to queue up and wait for an expert in its expert network to answer that question. Today, because you have ChatPG available, the number of queries that has been submitted through ChatPG is orders of magnitude greater than ever went through the expert network. So people had these questions, they just weren't getting answered because either people were embarrassed to ask, or it just took too long and they weren't quite sure when they'd get an answer. So they just sort of assumed stuff. Making that information transparent in the organization has absolutely helped P&G become a more effective company. Now, yeah, do you step on some toes occasionally? Sure. But it's definitely better than what was happening beforehand.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because the companies I've worked with, many started off with, we're going to buy an enterprise-wide GPT. Everybody go build custom GPTs. And so that's what they did. 1,200, 1,300 GPTs built, and very short period of time. Analyzing the data, about 900 of them weren't active. 300 of them were never used. You know, you get down to like 10 or 15 that are actively being used and actively kind of driving forward. And what was interesting is we talked to the business units. They said, well, I upload this and then I download it and then I pull it into this custom GPT built. And we're like, so we got to just hook you up to the data source. You can do that. And so I found it interesting, this intersection of let these be autonomous, let the tentacles do what they need to do. But there is a little bit of education around IT infrastructure or productization of AI that I believe IT owns in the education of the company. And yes. I don't know that I have seen, well, at least to the clients I've worked with, IT take that. Hey, let me, if I'm going to democratize IT, then let me give you the product, actually the connection to the data, the RBAC, the all those things. And now you can go. But it feels a little bit reversed. Oh, go play, go do your thing. And then IT is like, oh, but I'm going to build all this back here. I'm like, wait.
I have an article in CIO Magazine basically saying that this is maybe the best opportunity CIOs, IT has ever had to lead organizational transformation. Now, that doesn't mean doing everybody's job. It doesn't mean that that IT remakes marketing, but it does mean really being a partner to the business and making them aware of all that they can do and putting in the plumbing and being very responsive to the needs of their customers inside the business. If they can do that, there is enormous potential to have an impact. We have a case study in the book of Moshkan Lefebvre, who's the CIO, but also the chief operations person at Travelers Insurance. The fact that she has both those hats is very instructive. So she has been able to really push AI throughout the business that makes Travelers lower cost, more responsive, more effective, cheaper, faster, better, all at the same time. But it requires that holistic viewpoint about how IT can be used. And look, I think it's a wonderful time to be in IT, but they've right. got to not just be the masters of long-term projects. They really have to be infused in the business.
So who do you think really owns the transformation in a company? Because many say, oh, we now need a chief of AI, or it's the chief operating officer, or it's the CFO. And in some instances, the CIO reports directly to the CEO. In some instances, they don't. Sometimes they report to the chief operating officer or potentially, in some instances, the CFO I've seen. Who do you think really should be leading this charge? You know, obviously, besides the CEO setting that vision, is there somebody you feel is best poised within the organization to be the point person for the CIO or the CEO?
So that's a great question. I think it depends on the organization and the people. The CIO may be the right person. It really depends on their orientation and the capabilities of their department. So if they can do it, great. A COO might be more natural, but ultimately where the rubber's going to meet the road is the general managers, the heads of business units or functional heads. Now, oftentimes they're going to have to be working in a collaborative sort of way. So there should probably be a working group, a very senior working group where this happens.
Yeah.
But they're the ones who are going to make the change happen. And they're also going to be the ones filtering the need for the organization to IT to make sure that IT is focused on the right stuff. And they've got to have to have that negotiation with IT to really set the priorities.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about transformation and change, luck, the luck framework.
Yes.
So I love that. And the one thing that jumped out at me was controlled chaos. And there was a recent podcast with Michael Dell, and I don't know if you heard him. And he said, if there isn't a crisis, create one to ensure your team is reminded of their mission. And I thought of that when I was reading this and thinking, have companies created enough crisis around AI to get people motivated? Is there enough chaos around what's going on to remind people what's really important? What are we really trying to accomplish here with AI? What's your kind of thoughts on that?
So it goes back to John Cotter with change management, talking about the need for a burning platform for change. If you don't have the burning platform, it doesn't happen. What I've been seeing is companies getting a mandate, often from on high, and then using that as a mandate for change. But it's not just use AI. I mean, there's all sorts of those mandates. But there's a healthcare company we work with, for instance, that is looking at healthcare economics and saying we should expect that we're going to get a budget cut of maybe 25% in the coming 2 to 3 years because the current path is simply unsustainable. And we need to be ahead of that. We need to be prepared for how we're going to be able to cope in that sort of situation. Now, that's a negative way of framing it. There are also positive ways, right? Like HelloFresh, of we need to premiumize because we are super custom. So right. How can we do that and create a lot of differentiation through the data that we have? That's one of those big, hairy, audacious goals that is really exciting, I think, to the right. Organization. And you can do both, right? You can have the bold costs as well as the bold revenue mandates. But there does need to be a bold mandate. And it's not, let's use a technology mandate. It's a business objective.
Yeah.
Or set of business objectives. Then AI is part of the answer. It's probably not the whole answer, but it's part of it.
Yeah, I like that framing because I do think that starting with the business problem and what problem am I actually trying to solve here? For years when we worked at Salesforce, we're a customer company. It's about the customer. It's about the customer data. But with all due respect to Salesforce, it was about a bunch of different clouds that really didn't connect it. And at the end of the day, you needed to build a whole bunch of customizations to really accomplish what you needed to accomplish. It of course, went leaps and bounds from, you know, the former CRM systems of its days. And it did bring in a new set of technologies, but it really started as selling into the business. Hey, you don't need IT. You can just do this. And I was at Accenture at the time and I led the global deployment at Dell. And it was the first time where we connected to a customer master. And IT became the center of that entire transformation for Dell with Salesforce. And Salesforce was like, now I need IT involved if I want to go to the enterprise because sales doesn't know how to access the data and all the information. And so it was interesting because I don't know that it changed the relationship between IT and the business as AI will, but it was one of those first steps of, wait a minute. This is inherently different, guys. Yeah. Oh, two final things. If I'm an executive listening right now, what is the one piece of advice you give them about becoming an octopus organization?
Microsoft likes to talk about having work charts instead of org charts. Deconstructing, not everything, because that's going to be overwhelming, but let's look at a major task that your organization has, no matter what size of organization you have, what level an executive you are. Think about the units of work involved, not the jobs and job descriptions. And then how can AI really remake that? How do we create the assembly line, not just the one-for-one swapping out of electricity for steam? I think that's a useful place to begin to think about what's possible. There's a lot else, but that is a tractable place to start.
No, that's a good point. We appreciate you taking the time today. The book is really, really good. It really is applicable and it's easy to apply. I would think that there's a lot of things here that you could just pick up and start doing, which I think it's not theoretical. Theoretical is great, but I think what people need is practicality. So we will put the link to the book in the show notes and I encourage everybody to give it a read. And I appreciate you, Steve, taking the time and talking to us today.
I enjoyed it. Thanks, Rich.
Great. Thanks.